The information in this skill is provided for informational and educational purposes only. Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Multiple Sclerosis Flash Briefings. When your relapsing multiple sclerosis begins to change, how you treat it should change too. Think beyond relapses and choose a treatment that can help delay disability progression. Find out more at changesinrms.com.
My name is Jennifer Powell. I am a columnist with Multiple Sclerosis News Today. Today, I will be discussing how early MRI findings may predict disease worsening in children with MS. Abnormalities detected on MRI scans at the onset and within the first 2 years of disease may predict disability worsening in children with multiple sclerosis, a 9-year study reports. Specifically, damage in the spinal cord, brain, and optic nerve plays a major role in predicting outcomes in these patients, underscoring the need for comprehensive imaging tests early on. They found that children with MS exposed to high-efficacy disease-modifying treatments in the first year of disease had lower disease activity in the 9-year follow-up. The study, titled Early Predictors of 9-Year Disability in Pediatric Multiple Sclerosis, was published in the Annals of Neurology. MS is characterized by the loss of myelin sheath, or fatty protective coating that covers nerve fibers. This myelin loss results in MS lesions, or the brain or spinal cord, that can be identified through imaging tools such as an MRI. In adult MS patients, MS lesions have been shown to be linked to the development of clinical disability within 5 to 7 years after the first clinical signs of disease. In children, MS is typically characterized by higher levels of clinical activity, relapse rate, and MRI activity compared with adult-onset MS. However, little is known about how these early clinical and MRI features may influence the long-term clinical outcome of these patients, the researchers wrote. Furthermore, given the small number of approved DMTs for pediatric MS, it appears extremely relevant to identify risk factors for disease progression in these patients, the team added. Therefore, the researchers analyzed a group of pediatric MS patients to identify early clinical and MRI predictors of disease course. In total, 123 children with relapsing remitting MS followed at San Rafael Hospital, Milan, Italy, were enrolled in the study. Data was gathered at disease onset after 1 and 2 years and at the last clinical visit. The median follow-up duration was 9.4 years. DMT exposure, MRI scans, relapse rate, and disability levels were assessed. First, the team tried to identify predictors of the time to first relapse and of the average number of relapses in 1 year, or annualized relapse rate. The time from disease onset to first relapse ranged from 0.2 to 13.7 years, with a median of 1.7 years. The presence of optic nerve lesions was found to be a predictor of the time to first relapse, with a hazard ratio of 2.1, which means that patients with lesions in the optic nerve were 2.1 times higher of developing a first relapse within the first year. High efficacy DMT exposure could also independently predict the time to first relapse with a hazard ratio of 0.31, meaning that treatment reduced the risk of relapses. lesions in the cerebellum region of the brain at disease onset and exposure to high-efficacy DMTs were both associated with lower ARR. In contrast, lesions in the spinal cord predicted a higher ARR. The researchers also found that the higher the number of relapses during the first year of disease, the higher the ARR would be. ARR over the first 9 years of disease was in part predicted by baseline lesion distribution. In details, cerebellum lesions were associated with lower ARR, where cervical cord lesions were associated with higher ARR. The team then assessed disability worsening over the 9-year follow-up. In this period, 13 of the 123 pediatric patients experienced disability worsening. Patients whose disease worsened had a higher number of new brain MRI lesions and greater EDSS change at 1 and 2 years after disease onset, compared with patients who did not experience disease worsening. More specifically, the presence at MS onset of optic nerve lesions was associated with a higher probability of 9-year disability worsening. Odds ratio, or 6.45, meaning a 6.45 higher chance compared to patients without lesions in the optic nerve. Furthermore, EDSS changes during the first 2 years of disease, as well as the presence of at least 2 new brain T2 MRI lesions, were also associated with an increased probability of 9-year disability worsening. T2 MRI lesions represent the total lesion load. Next, the researchers looked at factors that could predict the EDSS score at 9 years after MS onset. Of note, a higher EDSS score indicates greater disability. They found that the EDSS score, the presence of brain lesions, and the number of spinal cord lesions at MS onset were predictors of a higher 9-year EDSS score. At 1 or 2 years after MS onset, an EDSS change and 2 or more new T2 lesions were associated with a higher EDS score at 9 years. Overall, a complete baseline MRI assessment and an accurate clinical and MRI monitoring during the first 2 years of disease contribute to predict 9-year prognosis in pediatric patients with multiple sclerosis, researchers wrote. High efficacy DMT exposure over the first year of disease reduced disease activity over the 9-year follow-up, the team concluded. Baseline cervical cord, brainstem, and optic nerve involvement by lesions have a major role in predicting 9-year outcomes, both in terms of disease activity and disability worsening, underscoring the need for a complete central nervous system comprising the brain and spinal cord MRI assessment at baseline.
Coming up next, perspectives from MS News Today columnist Ed Tobias.
You always do what you can to keep your relapsing multiple sclerosis in check. But if your relapsing MS is starting to change, it can affect your mind and body in new and different ways. So it's important to choose a treatment that goes beyond relapses, one that can help you stay ahead of disability progression. Take charge of your relapsing multiple sclerosis. Learn more at changesinrms.com.
Hi, I'm Price Wooldridge. As a rare neuromuscular disorder patient myself, I enjoy reading the column by Ed Tobias, MS Wire. What do the Oscars and our COVID-19 response have in common? What could the Academy Awards and COVID-19 possibly have in common for people with disabilities? Stay tuned and I'll tell you. First, the Academy Awards. The documentary Crisp Camp, about a summer camp for young adults with disabilities, was up for an Oscar. Its co-director and co-star, Jim Lebrecht, has spina bifida. Lebrecht uses a wheelchair, and he had hoped to ride from his front row seat up a special ramp to claim the Oscar for Best Documentary. I've always seen that stage with its stairs as a symbol that they don't expect people who had mobility issues to be nominated or to win an award, Lebrecht told the Associated Press. It's always been this kind of negative tacit statement. Sadly, Lebrecht never used the ramp, as an Academy Award for Crisp Camp wasn't in the cards. Watching the show, I saw Lebrecht in his seat because I knew about his movie's nomination, and I was looking for him. But I doubt that others in front of their TVs, or even in the audience, knew that Lebrecht was there in his chair, or that the ramp, which able-bodied winners vaulted onto from the side, was built because of his needs. But he did make it onto the Oscars red carpet, and he caught the attention of writers from Variety and other Hollywood publications. Actress and MS patient Selma Blair walked that carpet a couple of years ago. As Lebrecht tweeted from his seat at the edge of the ramp, "Most accessible Oscars ever." So losing wasn't a total loss. COVID-19 has its own hurdles. The COVID-19 testing and vaccine systems could use some ramps of their own. A little less than a year ago, a post on the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health website pointed an accusatory finger at agencies that run COVID-19 programs. COVID-19 has highlighted the gaps in equitable situations for people with disabilities, and that really has to change. That's part of the reason that there's a greater risk for people with disabilities in developing COVID-19. Disability inclusion expert Bonilyn Swinor told the Bloomberg School's Melissa Hartman. Swinor cited as an example drive-through testing and vaccination sites that don't work for someone who is unable to drive. She also noted that something as seemingly simple as frequent hand washing isn't always possible for someone with disabilities. And if a person needs a caregiver, physical distancing is almost impossible. We need disability data. In a follow-up interview in late March, Swinor noted that the gaps have absolutely persisted. At the start of the pandemic, problems included access to information and COVID-19 testing and social distancing. Then, as time passed, the gaps included scheduling a vaccination appointment via computer and getting into some vaccination sites. Perhaps things are now improving as COVID-19 vaccines have become more widely available. But we can't know for sure, Swinor pointed out, because a huge data gap exists when it comes to people with disabilities. For years, data have been collected at healthcare facilities regarding a patient's age, race, and sex, and even their zip code, but not a patient's disability. We can't look at the outcomes in this moment of the pandemic, or really at any time, to look at differences in healthcare safety, access, or different types of outcomes, Swinor told the Bloomberg School's Grace Fernandez. A pair of positive efforts. Last February, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden created a COVID-19 health equity task force to address health inequities. Hopefully, people with disabilities will be included in those whose data are being tracked. At about the same time, the Johns Hopkins Disability Health Research Center and the Center for Dignity and Healthcare for People with Disabilities launched a COVID-19 vaccine prioritization dashboard to gather data to help them better understand how COVID-19 programs have been handling people with disabilities. Hopefully, efforts like these will bear some fruit. But Swinor suggested something else. Whenever a discussion about inclusion occurs, people should ask, "Is disability included?" We all should be invested in this process, because disability is the one minority group that anyone can join at any time, she said. So true.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our Multiple Sclerosis News Today forums, a trusted MS community ready to welcome you anytime.